Now that opening music, even though it's like you get used to it after a while, it's still a little pick me up.
Yeah, it's great.
I kind of almost want to play it again.
That little ding at the end just wakes you into enlightenment.
It's just like a little door being opened into your. It's like your third eye opens when that ding happens.
That's right.
Plus, it's a sound like there, you know, are harmonies that kind of like, you know, might consider divine or sacred. That ding is terrifying to the evil robot birds.
It is. It makes them fly around. You know, we've got two special robot bird spies living right outside the door of the retreat center up in the little roof there.
Nice.
And they live there and hover and take pictures of everything and record everything. And it's just amazing.
What a wonderful world we live in. For those people who have tuned in, like, what the hell are we watching? Because two middle-aged white dudes are talking about robot birds next. It's an inside joke. And let's introduce ourselves so you know who you're listening to. I'm Mark Van Steenwyck. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
And this is transmission. So what we do is we... 207 episodes in, usually something at the intersection of radical politicky stuff and mystical spirituality stuff, which is a whole
and robot birds.
Well,
because birds are
at the center of the Venn diagram. Yeah,
that's right. That's
birds are not real. Live. But we are talking about a topic we cover a lot, often indirectly, discernment. Contrasting that with decision making, we've been kind of talking about that in more of a political lens this week. And to spring off, we want to dive into the topic du jour, critical race theory.
Yeah, well, but we also haven't mentioned what day it is.
Oh, it's Fascism Friday.
It's Fascism Friday. Everybody's favorite.
I don't know when we first started needing to focus on fascism, and then it's like now we're stuck. We can only ever talk about fascism on Fridays because it's Fascism Friday.
It's such a relevant topic. It's not going away.
No.
Right. So this whole critical race theory is the latest tempest in a teapot, especially for those on the white right. They're all losing their shit about this in a very dramatic and impressive kind of way. And first of all, this is a great example of political messaging because 99.9% of the people who are talking about this have no idea what critical race theory even is. Right? So
I'm sure they just think it's cultural Marxism is what they, I mean, that what people are always, people who complain about that are generally think they're complaining about the same thing.
You know, but there are plenty of people who don't even use those big words. It's just like white people are bad. That's what it is.
You
know? Yeah. and you know, the entire thing, I mean, this has become the flashpoint for this much more interesting and significant question of, you know, how do we talk about the history of America? I mean, it's really pretty simple. It's not very complicated, right? How do we talk about the history of America? And you know, the reality is that the way that American history is taught is incredibly white centric. And basically leaves out or minimizes all of the horrible things that have been done to Black, Native, other Asians, Hispanic folks, basically anybody that's not white, for the purpose of building this country the way that it is. And, you know, what a lot of people have been talking about more and more and more over the years, and it's gaining more and more steam, is that this isn't good. And we just need to talk about our history in a much more accurate and well-rounded manner.
Yes. And part of the reason
why... Which you would think wouldn't be controversial.
Well, here's the thing. So I've seen memes like this, and I've written things of a similar sort, and I think a lot of people have pointed this out, how the strangeness of a group of people who find it very easy to say that 6,000 years ago, Adam and Eve ate a fruit, and we all have to bear the consequences of their sin. But then, if you say our society is mired in white supremacy, they lose their shit. And part of it is, you know, and it's easy to make fun of that because it is ridiculous that you can have one view without and then get offended at the other one. But it has to do with this very individualistic way of seeing reality. Like, conservatives tend to think that the most determinative thing in society is the sum total of individual righteousness or individual sinfulness collected and gathered up. That's kind of that system. Social systems aren't really things exactly. The idea that critical race theory assumes baked in narratives that are so baked into a group of people and its structures that it can warp their perception of reality. Mm-hmm. And if you only think about things in terms of individuals, individual will, you know, individual sin, you're going to say that is kind of crappy, especially when the losers of that are white men, and deep down inside you believe that white men are the standard bearers for the glories of Western civilization. And now they're coming under attack, and because they're so under attack more than anyone else in public discourse, perhaps white men are the most oppressed people in the world today. Like, this is all works together in their minds around this.
Yeah.
So then if you start talking about discernment, which is what we're talking about, like, how do you understand your place in that system? Discernment becomes almost impossible if you're that baked in to this really wretched way of seeing things.
Right. And that baked inness, right, is the opposite of what discernment talks about in terms of cultivating spiritual indifference, right? And so in this reaction to critical race theory, which again is just the placeholder for this entire undertaking, right? Mm-hmm. So in the reaction to that, what we see is how both individuals and a whole group of people are trying to hold on to a predetermined vision of reality and not admit any other data or information. Right? And so this creates this blindness. Right. And one of the great, two very concrete examples of this. So first of all, you know, there's just been a discussion of the 100th year anniversary of the Tulsa massacre. Right.
Yes. Which isn't unique, by the way. Like, people have been pointing this out. Like, it's because of the scale, it's a ridiculous level of violence, and then how no one really in the white America had even heard of it. That's why it gets a lot of attention. But there are other examples of this that have happened.
Yeah, many, many others.
Yeah.
Right. But most white people have never heard of this event. Mm-hmm. And it is certainly not discussed in terms of the idea of, the United States supposedly is based on these values and laws and everything, except when white people want to break all those things. And then they do that with absolute impunity. Right. And not only was there the event itself, but then, for example, a very interesting aftermath of the event. Right. So this entire black neighborhood is destroyed. Hundreds of people are killed. And this is a very wealthy, very successful black business district. One of the interesting aftermaths is that, of course, all those businesses had insurance, and so they filed insurance claims. And all of those claims were systematically denied. And when some of those people tried to go to court to have those insurance policies enforced, that was also all systematically denied. Right. So not only was the initial event an event of terrorism and murder and mayhem and all kinds of horrible violence, right, that all the white people got away with. But in the aftermath, when the black people attempted as citizens of the United States to exercise their rights, their business rights, that was also systematically denied, right? And none of this is talked about. None of this is taught. None of this is talked about. That's one great example. Another great example is this series, The Handmaid's Tale, mm-hmm. right? Which is a great TV show, basically talking about, you know, the rise of this white fascist theocracy in America. And of course, all kinds of people are terrified by this. Oh my God, this is so horrible. And what some people have pointed out is that, isn't it interesting how this is viewed as so terrible and horrible because the people it's happening to in the show are white people. And nobody seems to be talking about the fact that we had The Handmaid's Tale here for hundreds of years. the exact same situation, right? Black women forced to breed, their children taken away from them, you know, people killed and tortured, people imprisoned, all these things. I mean, we had The Handmaid's Tale. And we acted as if...
trying to escape to Canada.
People trying to escape, right, to Canada.
And then Canada, like, having to deal with whether to send them back or not, like, all that stuff.
Yep, all the things. And yet nobody is going, oh, this isn't a future tale. This is actually a past tale. And maybe we white people should go, wow, look at how bad we feel when this is happening to white people. Maybe we should feel equally bad that we did this to black people for hundreds of years. Right? So those are just two examples of the way in which this entrenchment prevents discernment. Right? And that's the classic model. Our entrenchment, our habits, the systemic powers that form us, all of that prevents true discernment and the development of a just and loving society.
And it's just to add another little piece to this, and it's why it feels strangely ironic to me. Like, so we can dump on evangelicalism as being kind of the, perhaps one of the worst examples of this way of being. But that's the tradition that has the biggest emphasis on conversion, that it's possible for the Holy Spirit to interrupt your norm so much that in a period of like very emotional catharsis, you can be transformed and see the world differently. Right? And think about how powerful that is if that were understood expansively and in a deeper way. Mm-hmm. And it's not. I find it bizarre and sickly hilarious that these traditions that will most emphasize the power of the Holy Spirit to subvert expectation, norms, and ways of being in the world. It's almost like there's a demonic or robot bird plot to keep that bracketed into how you deal with your secret masturbations rather than talking about what it means to be racist. I mean, you have these examples. It's not like, you know, people talk about Finney and hit the Second Great Awakening, how when he'd have people come forward to accept Jesus in their heart, they'd come up and he'd also have them fill out an abolition card. So it's not as, these things haven't always been alienated from each other. There have been justice movements that are intertwined up with this sort of conversionist or mystical transformation kind of way of thinking about things. So there's possibilities there.
Yeah.
Comments are coming in. Carol says, happy Friday. And there's, it looks like a flamenco dancer.
Hey, Carol. Yeah. Thank you, Carol.
One word, predestination. I feel like we were meant to have this comment and read it right now. Joseph writes, I'm reading Gerald Horn's Counter-Revolution of 1776. He flips our revolution concept on its head. The English monarchy was veering toward abolition at the same time the colonial settlers were developing into a well-off merchant class. They needed to stop abolition to revolt. That's another part of the story that is clearly, and it's not even hidden. You can go read stuff talking about how slavery was, there was economic factors for why we revolted, and slavery was a huge part of the economy. It was a part of it. But if you bring that up now, conservatives will act like it's revisionist history, and you should not be able to say that in public schools or you're fired. That's where we're at as a society.
Yep, yep.
Women, period, forced to breed. Yes, not just enslaved black women in the 1800s. You're right. There's been a long tradition of forced, all kinds of forced mm-hmm. things. Joseph says, Horn also says that the Black Wall Street wealth in Tulsa was because that community was one of the few that actually did receive their promised 40 acres. The wealth had compounded and resulted in backlash from whites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, and as Mark said, this was not the only such incident. I know we've mentioned the Wilmington, North Carolina incident in 1899, where, again, the entire town and black infrastructure, politicians, all of this were murdered, destroyed. I mean, it was happening all across the country in through the early mid-20th century. And you know, and over again, these kinds of things would occur. The white folks would get away with it. There was no, you know, rule of law. All of our great American values suddenly seemed to not apply, right? And so, you know, talking about these things, and this is the interesting also experience of the process of discernment, right? So when you begin to let go of all of these formational habits and patterns, mm-hmm. you enter into the state of what the Buddhists talk about as groundlessness, right? So you suddenly are unmoored, because what this worldview does is it creates for us an entire set of markers and framework and prescriptions and, you know, value statements. It basically orients us to reality. And when you begin to let go of all those habits, you feel unmoored, right? You feel groundless. You feel like, well, I don't know, like, what's going to happen? Does that mean, you know, everybody hates me because I'm white? Does that mean, you know, I'm not going to be able to function, right? Does that mean that I'm going to get oppressed? Is that right? And so all of this fear and anxiety rises as we enter into this state of groundlessness, right? And this is one of the reasons why spiritual practices are supposed to be communal, because we do need support as we're allowing ourselves to enter into that different frame of being. And so that's where this reaction comes from, is that it's sort of terrifying to think of, you know, upsetting the apple cart, so to speak, of my entire life. And of course, then there's this immediate assumption that, well, you know, the alternative is going to be worse. And so I'm going to fight tooth and nail to keep trying to put this thing back together. But if what we're putting back together is unjust, is fascist, is harmful to people, over time, it's going to keep falling apart. Right? And that's what the basic theories of, you know, revolution or collapse or, you know, imperial disintegration are all about, is that you can only maintain that sort of oppression for so long.
Mm-hmm. You know, it can also bring in, you know, we were mentioning intersectionality before the jump, like intersectionality, the idea of identity politics, all these things kind of are swirling around when the big bad of critical race theory or postmodern neo-Marxism, any of these sorts of things, it's all talking about all these things. The being upset about cancel culture, these are all interwoven. And part of the fascinating thing, again, about this is if you're your generic, even centrist or conservative white male, and you hear people around you talking about identity politics, it's upsetting because you think that you're beyond that. Because white masculinity is so dominant, we are fooled into thinking that we have a regular identity, and that someone else who comes around who finds identity in their blackness seems like an aberration, and they seem threatening. And why are you trying to divide us? It's because we don't realize that the baked-in things of the empire are most clearly represented in the internal structures of a white man, right? So this is threatening. Just to underline it, the irony then is we're upset about other people trying to explore identity in deep ways because we're ignorant of it, because actually all of society is shaped around forming our identities. And so then, of course, if someone starts picking at that, and because we are alienated, like this, I don't think there's anybody more alienated in some ways than the white man, right? Because we've so internalized whiteness, and whiteness isn't being European descent. Whiteness is a set of assumptions that white supremacy and whiteness are kind of the same thing. And because we're so insecure, because we're so disconnected from life, we don't even know what life is supposed to be like. Anyone who picks at it and says, you know, the way you bring whiteness in the world is toxic, we start freaking out and are the most insecure and thin-skinned of humans. This is where white fragility comes in. Now, what does this have to do with discernment? Everything. You have to be able to stare into the void to do discernment. You talk about groundlessness. There is this deeply unsettling thing about discernment or conversion or any of these sorts of mystical things or encountering the Spirit of God, because there has to be some level of willingness to be transformed or changed or to see the world differently. And we are so addicted to our positions of power that any question of it feels like we are being victimized, and that's a toxic place to be.
Yeah. And to show, I mean, this is baked in some just amazing ways. I mean, like Deborah and I talk about this all the time, because in medicine, like when you're going through medical school and you're hearing about, you know, how do drugs work, how do different diseases work, every single thing is based on studies and metrics with the 70 kilogram man. Right. And, you know, white man. Mm-hmm. And you just hear this over and over and over again, the 70 kilogram man, the 70 kilogram man. And then, you know, suddenly you go out into the world and the world is not made up of just 70 kilogram men. Right? And yet this is the absolute norm. And, you know, nobody or very, very few people, you know, raise their hand and go, well, what about women? What about people of different colors? What about people that don't weigh 70 kilograms? What about, right? And yet, you know, this is just a great example of how literally every single thing in this field of medicine revolves around this idealized white man. So it's just everywhere.
Don't forget the untold genocide that U.S. America, Canada, Mexico, etc., brought on indigenous people at every chapter of New World European settler history, including to today. I also want to make it clear, like, we're talking about these historical moments. It's not to say that somehow that's all done. No. We might not have Tulsa massacres exactly the same way, but we're seeing the continued decimation and destruction of Black communities. It's just tactics change. I mean, it's not an accident that people are upset about critical race theory right now? It's because Black Lives Matter happened, and you have George Floyd, and all of a sudden you had Trump as a part of the white backlash, and then he lost the election, but most of the Republicans think he didn't lose, and that's just, this is all continuing forward.
Yeah, and it's not an accident that you can go, you know, to a graveyard in northern Minnesota that's a white graveyard, and it's pretty much all old people who are buried there. And you can go to a graveyard on one of the numerous reservations up here. And one graveyard that I went to, it was half kids under 16. Right? So there's just one data point, right? And so, you know, part of what all of this does is it starts us to asking, like, what is going on here? And that's what this basic process of discernment is about. And this is why it's a process of liberation, because you begin to open yourself up more and more to asking all these very uncomfortable questions, yet questions that are profoundly important about what is real and what has actually been going on. And you don't, you know, you continually are moving through these innate kind of reactions that are given to us by our formation, and we're allowing ourselves to let go of that and to keep going, you know, into that void.
Yeah, this, and just to kind of go back a little bit into the resistance of this, like, part of the other thing that's really messed up is the way education works in our society. Is there are people probably listening right now where nothing we've said today is new at all. They've heard it, yet they're still upset by this and they're reactionary against it. And in their mind, they're thinking, and I know I have people in mind right now, like the guy who sent the email about us being angry and effective. What happens is, it's like, why do you keep harping on this? I know this. Because they think that knowledge then percolates into action, that that's all you need is new information. And so when you hear someone like us bring it back up saying, look at society, or you have Black Lives Matter protesters, or anyone who raises these questions, the anger isn't just like people, a lot of white people will think, I agree with you. What? Stop bringing this up. Now you're the problem for being negative. What's your solution? Until you come up with a solution, I don't need to listen to you. You're the problem. Like, there's those sorts of things. Like, I remember when we shut down the Twins opener as a Catholic workers Black Lives Matter joint action, which, you know, is sacred. It was the Twins opener, so of course people are going to get pissed off by that. And I remember one guy was harassing my friend who had his baby in a stroller, just saying, I agree with all the what you, but you're doing it the wrong way, and, you know, maybe people would be more sympathetic, you know, if you didn't do things like this. So I stepped in there because, you know, my friend was trying to deal with the baby. And I said, are you telling me that you feel like you're more entitled to be more racist because Black people don't act the way you want? Is that what you're saying? He's like, well, what do you mean? I'm saying, like, that somehow you would be sympathetic towards Black people being killed, but you're not going to now because we're shutting down the Twins opener. Is that what you're saying? It's like, no, not me. I'm on your page. I'm on the same page as you. It's all these other people. Like, so this is what ends up happening, right? It's just all very tricky. Like, it's so obvious that he's feeling threatened and double downing on his narrative, but wants to somehow still be a good guy. So he'll at least grant that the content is accurate. In his mind, that's enough. And discernment is not about just having the right content. We started that with Monday. Mm-hmm. The discernment asks, what is it about this man that he can't engage truth? And what is it about what he's clinging to that's keeping him from deeper life? And what kind of life could he have? Like, all these questions can only really get got at through discernment. You can't just logic your way through this stuff. Okay, more comments coming in from Susan. Legislation, just like desegregation, force the change, attitudes will follow. Sometimes that's part of it.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, and you know, there's lots to do. That's the interesting thing. There's lots to do, and Yeah, and one of the things that I've been saying more and more about discernment as time goes by is that I just continue to really feel and have a sense for how incredibly radical it is. Because I will go into, you know, church spaces, other kinds of group spaces, and everybody's like, oh yeah, you know, we kind of get all this stuff. Yeah, we just want to make a decision about this, and we'll start doing a discernment process, and you can just watch people unravel.
Yeah.
And suddenly they, and at a certain point, they do start to recognize, okay, this is really different. And of course, then mostly what they say is, we don't like this, and yeah, let's go back to our brainstorming idea concepts. But if people are willing to stick with it, you know, some amazing things really start happening. But we really have to be willing to engage the process.
You know, this is, you know, it's again, to bring up an oft pointed out thing, you know, as we're talking about this and discernment in the spiritual life, you know, Jeff Bezos is putting these little phone booth or outhouse sized things in Amazon warehouses called Amazon, where people meditate. And to a lot of people, it's all the same thing. It's all squishy. And it's not like, so one of the things I like about how, you know, if you're ever in a retreat with Dan and he starts leading on centering prayer, you almost always will say, this should be called decentering prayer. And right there is this reframing of this, these spiritual practices aren't simply about coping through hard things, although there is something to that. Like there is something about being in touch with the body, allowing yourself to rest and feel some calm that can be very grounding and help you cope with hard things. But ultimately, spiritual practice is about disruption. And because of that, it causes more pain, usually before it causes comfort, because you're being asked to let go of something. When you're in the presence of the spirit and you're allowing yourself to be decentered, as you pay attention and notice what's going on inside you and outside of you, you're being invited into transformation and difference. And that's subversive and it's uncomfortable.
And that's what we hope we all do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're at our time. Thanks, Ed. And we will see you next week.
See you next week, everybody.
Bye. Adios.